Welcome to the first of two programmes hosted by Houseman's Bookshop. These programmes are based around events and talks which have been held in Houseman's Bookshops during July and August. Tonight, I am pleased to welcome four of our friends and long-time supporters who are talking at Houseman's. I'd like to welcome Merlin Coverley, who is the author of London Writing, Psychogeography, Occult London, and is currently working upon a book about utopias, which will be published in September. We're also joined by Ken Walpole, who has been involved in numerous projects, which regretfully we will not have the time to go into tonight at any depth, although we will be discussing his excellent book, Dockers and Detectives, and supporting his reprint Alexander Baron project. We're also pleased to welcome John Rogers, who not only produces the highly informative and entertaining Islington to Leytonstone blog, but has also produced a film called The London Perambulator about Nick Papadimitriou. Last but by no means least, we're joined by Laura Oldfield Ford, who produces the magazine fanzine Savage Messiah, a bargain at £2, available at very few select and discerning outlets. Laura is also an established artist who exhibits art galleries. However, if you have an aversion to galleries, you are always more than welcome to join Laura on one of her many walks that are integral to her work. Before we start the discussion, I would also like to mention Five Leaves Publishers and London Books, who are both committed to reprinting essential London books. Houseman's is to be found on Caledonian Road in King's Cross, where it has been for 50 years. This year we will be celebrating our 50th anniversary with a party. However, to kick off the programme, I'd like to quote two extracts of writing about King's Cross. King's Cross is an area where terrible things happen to people, to buildings, to cars, to trains, usually while you wait. And if you weren't careful, you could easily end up involved in a piece of exciting and challenging dialogue yourself. You could have a cheap car radio fitted while you waited, and if you turned your back for a couple of minutes, it would be removed while you waited as well. Other things you could have removed while you waited were your wallet, your stomach lining, your mind, and your will to live. The muggers and pushers and pimps and hamburger salesmen in no particular order could arrange all these things for you. This is an extract from The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, written by Douglas Adams, who used to live in Islington, and whose Dirk Gently books are based around Islington. Another quote, "He who cannot find wonder, mystery, awe, the sense of a new world and an undiscovered realm in the places by the Gray's Inn Road will never find those secrets elsewhere, not in the hearts of Africa, nor in the fabled hidden cities of Tibet. The matter of our work is everywhere present," wrote the old alchemist, and that is the truth. "All the wonders lie within a stone's throw of King's Cross Station." That's a quote from Arthur Machen, The London Adventure. As Houseman's is situated in 5 Caledonian Road, King's Cross, we'd like to think that he was referring to us, but obviously he wasn't. However, to kick off the conversation this evening, I'd like to ask Ken Walpole to briefly talk about what I've classified as the Dig Where You Stand tradition.
Yeah, thanks, Malcolm. Dig Where You Stand was the slogan of the early oral history movement, which I think really gets going in the 1960s. And this was a response to rather traditional history that often ignored the experiences of most ordinary people. And it kind of had a figurehead in East London in the person of Raphael Samuel, a historian, who was a Jewish historian as well as being a radical communist. And I think what was interesting that, and I think it will come up in this discussion here, is that why East London is particularly fascinating to people is that its character seems to ebb and flow with every generation. And I always see the identity of particular parts of London as a battleground, which over time get erased and then reinvented and so on. And I think why East London seems to be so important to the wider history of East London, partly, of course, is to do with it being a transition point for generations of different immigrants. But also, I guess, because it's a place where journalists, for an easy story, it's only just over the border from Fleet Street, have gone down there and written, often with very little knowledge. So you get people like Thomas Burke writing about Chinatown or Limehouse, characterising it as an air of kind of deep gloom and drug addiction and kind of wasted lives. People like Jack London or Arthur Morrison. And then you get kind of a rebuttal by people who actually live there trying to write their stories. So one of the very strong traditions in the East End of London, of course, is the Jewish novel. And I'm interested not simply because of these very unusual people are writing these books, but because part of the history of East London is also the history of very strong institutions, one of which is, for example, the Whitechapel Library, which the Jewish East End always said was their university, both painters and poets. And in September, actually on the 10th of September, the coming 10th of September, there's going to be an unveiling of a plaque at the Whitechapel Library commemorating its role in the story of Jewish East End life. So that's one aspect that interested me when I was writing Dockers and Detectives. The other aspect was, because I'm also very interested in politics, I've spent my life being interested in politics, is that the earlier political traditions, which I think we're in danger of losing, the socialist traditions particularly, well, they were also educational movements. So part of the oral history I did was interviewing people like Jack Dash, the Dockers leader, about the sorts of books he would read. I wasn't simply interested in what he did as a militant Docker, but how he came to be the educated, you know, lively mind that he was. And one of the things, and I interviewed lots of people about their reading, working class activists and writers and so on, and I suppose one of the things that we might later discuss here was that so many of them really did not like English literature. Jack Dash, when I asked him to name all his favourite novelists, he just listed a series of American novelists, John Dos Passos, Theodore Dreiser, Upton Sinclair, and later on, you know, obviously Hemingway. And they kind of saw this rather tough masculine tradition as being speaking more to their view of the world, with stories of police corruption, municipal corruption, gangsters, than the kind of rather genteel English detective story, which is set in a vicarage and a policeman arrives on a bicycle, just got off the 4:23 from Paddington. So I do see kind of the literature of London as a continuing battleground, as I said, and it's also involved in politics, and it's also constantly involved in this feeling that to write about London is always to engage in a continuing conversation and not ever to have the final word.
John, I wonder if I could bring you in here, because you've made a film about a friend of yours called Nick Pap. I can't really pronounce his
surname. Dimitri.
Right, well, we'll call him Nick from here on in, actually, if that's acceptable, worthy. And I'm quite interested because, as we've said before, one of the things that's quite interesting, there are, in your film, you have Will Self, Ian Sinclair, Russell Brand, and the film is ultimately about Nick, who perhaps belongs to a great tradition of English eccentrics. And the thing I find interesting is that obviously the three main figures in it are far more, dare we say it, famous than Nick. And I'd be interested to know how you met Nick and your relationship with him and how you got the people involved in this. And certainly, I think the one figure who sticks out slightly might be Russell Brand and Russell Brand's involvement in this film.
Yeah, I can see why that would be the case. I mean, I can answer two of those questions in one, really. It was Russell that introduced me to Nick about 5 years ago, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, because I'd been doing a psychogeographical sort of project in High Wycombe, where I'm from originally, where I grew up, and we produced a booklet, and I gave it to Russell. I've known Russell for about 10 or 11 years, doing comedy, sort of on the fringe and stuff, and I gave him this booklet, and then about 6 months later he rang me up and said, "You've got to meet this guy. He's a fella I've met in Hampstead, and you've got to meet him. You two will get on." He sort of set us up on a date, really. He sort of took us out, and Nick and I bonded over a shared love of sort of old topographical walking guides to like the edgelands of London, because I sort of stumbled across these when I was sort of researching the High Wycombe projects, because a lot of books in the early part of the 20th century sort of encouraging people to go out into areas that are now we would consider part of London, but to go and walk in these areas sort of around Ruislip and Amersham and Leytonstone, where I live now, and that sort of area. And Nick was an obsessive collector of these books as well. He's got an amazing library, which is covered in the film. So that's how I met Nick, and I just knew at that point when we started walking together that I put a camera on him, and there was a film. It wasn't like, oh, where's the film, you know, it just trips out of him, as you know, as you've seen the film, Malcolm. There's some of that early footage of Nick I shot is actually on YouTube. I think if you go on YouTube and you search deep topography, you'll come up with Nick and this early footage. So, but I sort of, there's the other characters involved in the film. I mean, Ian published Nick. In fact, Ian's the only person to publish Nick. He published him in City of Disappearances. Nick contributed a piece on Bedfont Court Estate, which is out near Heathrow. A wonderful piece of writing. So he sort of championed Nick a bit, sort of in the mainstream slightly. And Nick refers to his practice as deep topography. And I think he could probably lay claim to coming up with that. I remember Googling it when I first heard it come out of his mouth, and it didn't come up on it. And now Google is the definitive source of these things. I think Nick can claim that. And I heard Ian use it on Radio 4 one morning. And then Ian started using it at talks. I went to a talk at the Renoir when Ian was screening his film about Allen Ginsberg, Our Sunflower. And he said, yeah, you know, there's this thing, deep topography. And actually in my film, Ian renounces psychogeography completely, and he says, I've now signed up to deep topography. I wholeheartedly hereby renounce psychogeography forthwith. Because Nick's got no time for psychogeography. Yeah, he uses it as an expletive. He uses it in the way that people would use a word that we're not allowed to say on the radio, you know.
And Russell Brand's connection is, you've been friends with him for a long, long time, so it was an obvious person to put in.
Yeah, well, I've known Russell for a long time. He made the connection between mine and Nick's interest. And, you know, Russell's got an interest in psychogeography as well. You know, like going back a long way, I remember buying him London Orbital when it came out. He was really into that. And he's got a lot of, you know, he must be the only stand-up comedian to use psychogeography in his stand-up when he played The Roundhouse. You know, we were talking about Ian's film, actually, funnily enough, about Our Sunflower and about the Congress of the Dialectic that was held there, which ironically was 40 years before his gig, which was the end of 2007. So sort of Russ did this riff on the psychogeography of The Roundhouse, you know, and people really got into it. And he's got a lot of ideas on that. And there was a great bit of footage actually from the interview I wasn't able to use in the film because it was a sort of breathless 6-minute riff where, you know, Russell used to score drugs when he before he cleaned up years ago, way back, and at the bottom of the Centrepoint Tower. Now there's a really swanky members club at the top, so sort of drawing that analogy between going to that swanky members club, and then there's the front line around St Giles, you know, and there's the whole history of St Giles. And Will's self-involvement is Will is Will's an old friend of Nick. They go back a long way. I think 20, 25 years, I think they've known each other. Way back into sort of like the mid-80s when they used to go walking around places like Erith Marshes. And before that was sort of, you know, now these sort of like the Lee Valley. And you know, I think Erith Marshes are built, they're kind of like psychogeographical theme parks, aren't they, you know?
Yeah.
And but then, you know, people didn't really do that as a pursuit, or certainly didn't do it to write about it or make films about it. So they were doing that back in their sort of mid-80s, and they've been solid friends ever since. I mean, Nick crops up in a lot of Will's writing. He's in that psychogeography collection, actually.
Well, hopefully we'll get back to Nick. Talking about the Dialectors of Liberation, I feel I ought to point out that, interestingly enough, Houseman's Bookshop had a stall at the Dialectors of Liberation, so these things do top. I'd like to bring Laura into the conversation now. Laura, as I said, produces a magazine called Savage Messiah, and basically what she does is she organises walks, goes around certain areas, gets feedback from her own experiences, researches the areas, gets the feedback from the people, and then produces the magazine about it. And so far you've done... How many have you done?
Well, I'm up to issue 12 now. And so it's been going a while, about 4 years.
And is your ambition to do the whole of London?
I suppose so. But I never sort of think of it in those terms of in any way trying to conquer the city or take ownership of it. I'm quite happy to kind of engage with it in the way I do, which is quite slow sort of mapping, very subjective mapping. And... allowing it to be quite sort of random and never trying to really colonise the entire thing or, you know.
And I say, one of the things Laura and me have talked about a lot is when Laura does these walks, the most important thing for her is to get lots of people, and especially people who've got their own memories of the area, so that as you go around, it becomes more collective.
Yeah.
Sort of experience, rather than one person, sort of, as I think Laura said, like some sort of authoritarian voice saying, this is what's happened. It's an attempt to pull together both, especially cross-generational experiences, so you can hear the different voices of London as we go on.
I mean, I think that's really important, because when I put out flyers and publicity for my walks, I always say, this is not a guided tour, you know, because I wouldn't want to stand there and claim to be an expert. What I try and do is bring people together, in order that they can talk about their histories, their memories, and contribute in that way. Because really, what I'm trying to do with the walk is to coax out the hidden histories and the hidden narratives of the city that the planners and developers would rather erase when they're going through that whole process of rebranding areas. And also, you know, the way that certain aspects of working class culture, the attempt that's been made there to erase that. So when we're out on these walks, it's almost like allowing, I guess, a platform or a hub or something to form where people can come together and contribute, and then, you know, then different things can emerge from that. People can go away and write about it, make work relating to it, or, you know, and we get so many different types of people coming out.
And, of course, the other thing that was interesting is that that relates to something that's going on today is certainly when you did your walk around the Olympic site, which we all know is a highly contentious area, is actually to do with the whole privatisation of public space generally.
Yeah.
The whole way that, obviously, when you go around the Olympic site, I mean, what I remember is it didn't take long before security guards
appeared with Rottweilers.
With dogs that didn't look like the most friendly dogs we've met in our life. And obviously the thing that's interesting about this is it is not just the obvious places like the Olympic sites that are being privatised, the Loxley shopping centres and various other places are actually private spaces with their own security sort of systems.
Mm.
And there's that whole area as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other big theme that runs through my work, I suppose, that idea of contestation of space, which I guess links, you know, to what's been said before, but, you know, one thing that I've done on my walks is take out old maps and plotted routes through streets and thoroughfares that are no longer open to the public and sent people off, you know, to walk along these routes just so that they can actually encounter those impediments and obstacles that have been imposed, you know, through what's basically, you know, enclosure. And, you know, all these areas have been gated off and privatised. So much of what was our space has been taken away, particularly around King's Cross and obviously in the Lower Lee Valley. You know, this is what's happening. And part of my project is to really draw attention to the fact that our unpoliced space is being eroded all the time. And, you know, I mean, the Olympics is essentially just a corporate land grab, you know, and what's going to happen is it's just going to be a really boring corporate landscape space with loads of surveillance, you know. But what I'm more interested in is, I suppose, that Ballardian idea of what's going to happen after that, you know, when the economy's completely collapsed and, you know, nature reasserts itself in that environment. So,
right.
You know, a lot of the themes are interlinked in that.
Well, I'm not going to bring Merlin in because what I think is quite interesting is we've had Ken, who's talked about an aspect of the areas that we've been filming, John, who's made a film, Laura, who does that. And I'd like Merlin to talk about, without getting involved in the swear word psychogeography or deep topography, there is, I think I'd be right in saying, Merlin, that what interests you, there is quite a deep tradition embedded in English or British literature.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I came to psychogeography not as a practice, really, not as a means of walking the city, but really as a literary tradition, as a series of writers, beginning probably with Sinclair and Aykroyd and Ballard and Stuart Home in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And I was trying to trace the origins, really, back beyond Guy Debord and the Situationists in Paris in the 50s, and to see if it could be tied in with an older English tradition of writing about London. Particularly, what interested me was the idea of, as your quote from Arthur Machen suggested in your introduction, this idea of a hidden city, a visionary city that's somehow existing behind the everyday one, which certain writers and visionaries and artists can gain access to. And following that idea, I worked back from, as I said, Debord in the 50s and 60s to people like Machen, and then in the 19th century, Robert Louis Stevenson, who writes about London in Jekyll and Hyde, is this city that has a grand facade that conceals something hidden and sinister and occult behind it. And this can go all the way back to, well, really to the origins of the novel in English, I think, to writers like Defoe and then obviously Blake and Dickens and De Quincey, all who describe this London as really two cities, as changing on the surface, but behind that something unchanging, something visionary and magical.
I think this is where it goes back to a point that Ken made as well. One of the things that I find quite interesting is, both when you look at the books you've written and that, is there's also quite a lost history of London writing. Certain people, for certain reasons, seem to have been erased from London memory. And one of the authors we're both particularly interested in getting back in it, getting republished, is Alexander Baron. And I don't know if you'd like to say a few words about Alexander Baron, who we both think is quite a significant writer.
Well, I mean, his first book, From the City, From the Plough, which was published in 1948, was a story of the D-Day landings, and Baron himself had fought in the war and had been present at the D-Day and also present in fighting in Italy. He was a Hackney Jewish man, son of a tailor, tried to go to Spain to fight in the Spanish Civil War, very much of the left. Anyway, when he left the army, was, you know, demobilised in 1945, he was rather ill. He wrote this book, and it sold 500,000 copies. And for at least, you'd have to say, 10 years after the war, as far as most British people were concerned, there was only one war novel, which was From the City, From the Plough, by Alexander Baron. And then you kind of get this wave of kind of officer memoirs, Colditch story. Colditch, it should be remembered, was only for officers. And you get a kind of new layer of escape stories, which are all very wonderful. I mean, they're heroic and they're very moving and so on. But you get an overlaying of the ordinary soldier's experience and the Douglas Bader kind of stuff and the films that come out and so on. And then you get that tradition disappeared. Baron, in some ways, I interviewed him at length in the 1980s. I mean, he said he had great difficulty following that up because it was such a success. He wrote a number of novels about Spain, but he always resisted writing the Jewish novel, he told me, and then resisted also writing the East End novel. In the end, he succumbed to both. And his novel called The Low Life, published, I think, as I remember from memory, 65, possibly 61, actually, was an unusual novel in that, rather than setting the traditional East End, it was setting Hackney, and it portrayed that transition from the East End out to Hendon in the life of a Jewish Hoffman presser, who was also a loner and a gambler, most of whose other family had gone to Hendon and become very respectable, and he was caught between two worlds. It is a wonderful, wonderful novel, but it portrays kind of Hackney in a prosperous times, in rather warm human terms. And then he, in 1969, he did this sort of classic retake of Arthur Morrison's Child of the Jago, which was based on stories his own grandparents had told him about growing up around Bethnal Green in the right at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And this novel is called King Dido, and it's really a very graphic account of poverty and hunger and social unrest. And that's being published by Five Lewis Press in October. But Baron is such an interesting figure for so many reasons, and yet, you know, he's been forgotten.
John, could we perhaps talk a bit more about your film? One of the things that I find quite interesting about it is obviously it's not set in what I suppose you consider the classic. Ken's talked about the East End novels, yeah, and the certain areas of London that have been seem to attract, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This psychogeographical, whatever you want to describe it, this description. There are certain areas that have been well and truly mythologised. But where Nick's working, it doesn't have that same kudos, does it?
No, not at all. I think he's the only. It's his territory. He's the only one out there, isn't it? I mean, for Nick, it's not London. It's Middlesex, yeah. And that's part. I think this project is about almost sort of reconstituting the old administrative boundaries of the county of Middlesex, much of which is North London and parts of West London. So, in the film, it sort of goes from probably the nearest we get to anywhere what people would consider desirable or civilised is Golders Green, and then we sort of head out northwest through sort of Neasden to Stonebridge Park. These are all places actually are quite significant in those sort of early 20th century topographical books, because, you know, there's a wonderful chapter in Gordon S. Maxwell's The Fringe of London about a place called Monk's Park, which is 4 miles from Charing Cross, but where they only have one postal delivery a day, you know, which in 1921 was unheard of. And that Monk's Park is kind of Stonebridge Park, which was also the subject of a film by Patrick Keeler as well. He made a film called On Stonebridge Park. Completely coincidentally, actually, I emailed him about that, and it was just a coincidence that there was this kind of doubling up of significance. Yeah, and so and Nick's study sort of goes out around the area of Middlesex, around to sort of Feltham, really, and it ties in with his own personal history as well of sort of drug use and prison. You know, so we sort of go to Wormwood Scrubs. We walk along the canal out towards Heathrow, which was a walk that Will Self was doing, because he does these airport walks where he walks to Heathrow and then he gets a plane, in this case it was to Los Angeles, and at the other end he walks from LAX to Hollywood, as it was, to the Chateau Marmont Hotel, and then walked around LA for 2 weeks. And Nick walked the Heathrow end with him and filmed a bit of that walk through sort of like these light industrial estates and stuff. Yeah, Mogden Purification Works, I think, is kind of... That is, to deep topography, probably what the East End is to psychogeography, because kind of Whitechapel really is the psychogeographical heart, I think, isn't it? Ian made that famous. And so, for, you know, deep topography, it's Mogden Purification Works.
Yeah, Ken, you've got to...
Well, I do find it fascinating. I mean, what connects all the people sitting in this room is really this interest in what happens when you go walking.
Yeah.
And the kind of the way that city reveals itself and individuals reveal themselves. And I mean, it almost kind of to be a walker now, to be a rambler, is the most radical thing you can do, because we've exhausted all of the other ways of being in the city, because the transport system and everything else has kind of colonized it. And as you were saying, Laura, I mean, public space, you know, it's been carved up and subject to surveillance.
Yeah.
And I do find this very interesting, this walking aspect, and I wonder, it might be worth something we should talk about a bit more, because I mean, certainly when I got involved, it, you know, at the beginning of the 70s already, there was a significant walking figure there, which was Bill Fishman. You know, Jewish anarchist historian who organized walks every week, and amazing. And that was in a way was the continuity between the 30s and the 50s and 60s, was Bill Fishman doing these walks.
Yeah, I mean, I've often wondered about this, because I had the privilege of being brought up in a car, you know, in a family that didn't have a car. So I've always walked, tend to walk wherever I go. It's almost like a natural thing to me. I mean, I remember that quite often when I first came to London, you know, I used to say to people, and when I used to say to them, how do I get somewhere? They'd always say, well, you catch that bus, you go catch that tube or whatever. And I used to look on an A to Z map and think, you know, but this is what... a 20-minute walk, and, you know, so I just used to leg it and that sort of thing. I think Ken's quite right that, you know, walking, I mean, is walking, I mean, certainly I think that Laura will feel this, walking can become a, you know, subversive activity in a city nowadays, because I'm sure when we all walk around the city, you know, we all know that if you go in the city on a Saturday or Sunday, it's quite eerie, isn't it? You know, you're wandering around desolate streets, but you're completely aware of the fact you're being... you know, spotted by CCTV cameras wherever you go. And I think when Ian Sinclair was doing a film and they were filming around that area, within a few minutes, you know, they were being questioned by the police, what are you doing in these areas and that sort of thing. But one of the things I was going to... we've all gone about the walking, but one of the things I think was quite interesting talking about Nick is that there is a tendency to see a lot of the activity we do as exclusively city-based. But interestingly enough... little bit of useless information here, but one of the actions that Andre Britton took was to actually arrange a walk in the countryside, because I know most people associate the Survey, it's very much based in Paris with peasants of Narja and that. But he decided, with Louis Aragon, Max Maurice and Roger Fidrac, they decided to set forth from Paris. They went to a small village called Blois, which they selected randomly on the map. And then they spent about 4 or 5 days just wandering around the countryside trying to create a sort of ambience. So it's not, there is a tradition that isn't exclusively within the cities, but I think we all agree that most of the tradition that we all inhabit is within the cities, with the exception of Nick, who's Nick, yeah. And the, well, I think what people call the liminal spaces and that sort of thing, which
edgelands, they're really I think Ian talks about them, they are sort of they're the contested spaces, yeah. Really, because they're not green belt, and they're sort of like this, they are sort of kind of brown belt, if you like, because that's where the development, you know, there's no room to expand in the city centre anymore. You know, they've built as far as they can go. So they're pushing out into these liminal edge lands as far as possible. But also then you've got the kind of transition that's going on there, where these light industrial estates are kind of crumbling a bit. They're not involved in industry anymore. And they're sort of zones of distribution, really, mainly now. And that's what's kind of... You know, they are, and also infrastructure. You know, this is where you get kind of sewage works and electricity generating works as well. So they are kind of like the sort of mechanics of consumerism. That's where they exist out on the edgelands. And of course, you get the big mega stores like the IKEA stores, and Laura's drawn, you know, the IKEA riots as well. So that is probably where the action's going to happen. And, you know, you could say where the Olympic Park is, that again, that's classic kind of liminal space, that's edgeland. And if you go out to these places, sort of, you know, where I live, sort of northeast London, sort of Leytonstone through Walthamstow, there's so much, and Barnet, Enfield. I mean, Enfield, I think, in a way, is probably the most interesting place to study in London at the moment. If you want to see where the future of the city is, it's Enfield. That's the future. And sort of Ruislip and out to the, and High Wycombe, you know, and places like that. It's kind of, that's where we're heading. That's what Hackney's going to end up like. Yeah.
Well, actually, I've worked in Enfield. I used to work in a bookshop in Enfield, so, I mean, that's something I've got to look forward to. But, I mean, interesting enough, I mean, I find that Hackney's changed a lot in the 20-odd years that I've lived there, actually. And, I mean, I now move in the more Stoke Newington area. And in 20 years, Church Street has just changed phenomenally for me. Do you know what I mean? That it's great if you want to...
In a sense, I mean, you know, what John was talking about there, the liminal spaces. I mean, I find that interesting in the sense of being almost an inversion of patterns of poverty, in the sense that in the 80s, people used to talk about inner city blight and dereliction and the horrors of the inner city. But of course, this is where all the yuppies want to live now. And so along with all the industry and things that, you know, people maybe don't want to see, sewage treatment works and, you know, industrial estates or whatever it is, this is also where the surplus populations are being displaced to, you know, in these urban regeneration schemes. So, you know, what were once sort of genteel suburbs, you know, on the outskirts, that's where you're seeing the real poverty and deprivation. And as working class communities are being pushed out of Hackney, that's kind of where people are ending up, you know, Edmonton, Thamesmead, these kind of places. So, you know, it's almost like human populations are being pushed to these zones as well. You know, just thought I'd mention it.
No, that's right. I agree with that, because it's where all the shared ownership schemes are now, isn't it? Which is sort of the nearest we're getting to social housing, and they are all places sort of like around Ilford and Barking.
Well, trying to get artists to go there, because obviously there's that traditional regeneration thing of anarchists first, you know, squatters, then the artists, then the yuppies. And I was at a talk at Space Studios in Hackney the other day, and there was all these developers there trying to entice us as artists to move up to Edmonton, you know. As if, you know, we haven't invested years of time, you know, in an area like Hackney. We've got communities there, and they want us to go there because they think that's going to make it more attractive to developers, you know.
You should go there. Edmonton's cool.
Known as Shanktown, John, there is a reason for that.
It's
also known as Shanktown, isn't it?
Go on.
It means everyone's carrying blades around.
Ah, good God. it's frightening, Edmonton, in lots of ways, but they've got an IKEA.
So. Well, that's always worthwhile then, yeah.
Because that is that. I know this is an old... I'm not, you know, someone will source this for me, but, you know, like, really, Walter Benjamin probably would hang out at Edmonton IKEA, wouldn't he? That would be
the
where he would write
the
arcades product.
Brilliant.
Yeah, that's kind of the equivalent of the Parisian arcade is the this is from Patrick Keeler's London. This is where it's from, Brent Cross Shopping Centre. Yeah, and I sort of was up there. I did a walk up the River Lee recently from Walthamstow up to Edmonton, and I thought this walk has to end at that IKEA, because, you know, we always think we do a walk and where do I end? It's sort of significant, isn't it?
Edmonton incinerator plant is usually where I stop.
A lot of things end up there, don't they? Yeah. But when I finished in that cafe, I thought, well, this is the perfect place to end a walk, you know, this is it.
But coming back to the literary representation of these issues, I mean, I'm not a great reader of crime novels, and when I do read them, I tend to read them because I'm not interested in the plot, but I'm interested in the area they're writing about, in which they're set. So if I want to know about, you know, Nottingham or Edinburgh and so on, I'll go and pick up a crime novel set there. And I think psychogeography in its pure form is for a limited number of people, probably, but I think it has seeped in to many other kinds of literary forms, and probably the way in which people are now making films. And there is something about the mystery of place that does seem ineradicable, although we seem very worried about everything being concreted over. Somehow, you know, the weeds grow up again and the place becomes inhabited again. And a lot of artists around Europe are making interesting interventions, if you like, in these marginal areas. So this whole process of kind of dying and being born again, I think, goes on.
I mean, to take up Ken's point about crime, I mean, there's a writer I used to read called Leo Mallet, who was a French writer, who they started translating in this country, and then, as with most things, went out of print. And he was actually involved with a surrealist group between the 1930s and the 1940s. Then in 1943, he came across the American writers Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, and he was obsessed by that, to go back to your sort of thing, that almost masculine style of writing, the hard one. And he then created this person, a private detective called Nestor Burma. And what he did was he created a series called The New Mysteries of Paris. And what he did was consciously chose to, that each story was situated in the different arrondissement in Paris. So he recreated, you know, he went round the arrondissement of Paris. And he's actually quite an interesting writer in the sense, because he'd been knocking around in the 20s and the 30s. When I read it, I was quite stunned about some of the things he was writing about. He was writing about anarchist centres that were in Paris in the 20s, vegan centres that were in Paris in the 20s, which, you know, came as a bit of a shock to me. And because he was writing about crime novels as well, he had these people who were using the underground tunnels, the sewers and all this stuff, not as some sort of psychogeographical exploration of the city, but as means of bank robberies and that sort of thing. So in his books, you'd have people popping up like the third man. Do you know what I mean? Coming up through manhole covers and all that, and they were all doing crime. But what was very evocative about them, they were very evocative for each arrondissement. And I think Ken's got something there. Ian Rankin's books about the crime novel does seem to be able sometimes to really evoke the social conditions of a time. I'm not sure why, whether people situate them in a place that's already got some resonance. Because, I mean, there is a time you can, over a certain period of history, you know, I mean, there was a time when if you mentioned Notting Hill in a certain period of time, it immediately conjured up an idea for people, certainly Notting Hill in the 50s and the 60s. And then Hackney had that they almost had a, they already had a representation in popular consciousness. And I find crime novels actually quite, I agree with Ken, that they're quite useful as books to investigate, to get this sort of thing.
Can I ask Merlin? I mean, I'm very interested in, I mean, one of Merlin's books is about occult London.
Yeah.
Now, the word occult immediately kind of puts a big brick wall between me and the book. But on the other hand, I can understand why the occult was initially the great kind of embodiment of place, because it was about being haunted. And I wonder, I mean, could Merlin kind of talk about how he sees the relationship between the occult and then psychogeography, which is a bit divested of those slightly paranormal issues, and then the modern deep topography?
Well, I think psychogeography in its original incarnation tried to steer clear of the occult, and I agree that it is probably now of limited interest in a sort of narrow academic sense. But if you take the occult and to mean, broadly speaking, the hidden, then, I mean, it ties in once again with this history of London being somehow existing out of view and behind the scenes. I think the occult sense of London, that's psychogeography's been has come to be understood, is probably due to a couple of writers, I mean, namely Ian Sinclair and Peter Ackroyd, who seem to have made this very conscious attempt to depict London as this sort of site of strange happenings and occult events. But I'm not sure if looking back through London literary history, whether that really has a great deal to do with psychogeography. I think psychogeography is now largely split between people who protect the idea of this practice and this political component, this idea of some sort of subversive activity against the city, and also this idea of the occult as somehow, particularly in Ackroyd's expression, is somehow completely apolitical. This idea of London as this sort of unchanging, hidden place that exists and changes quite beyond our involvement with it.
I think there's, you know, there's a couple of interesting points there. One is, I mean, I think that the classic phrase of psychogeography, which is the board in the lecturist sort of things, the part of point behind that was that the other thing they talked about was creating situations. It was a means of actually involving yourself in activities in the city and provoking a sort of thing. That's got a specific meaning. And then as you go on, I mean, I think that the occult side of London, you've got the fascination with people like the Golden Dawn, who were based in London, the Yeatsian connection. And obviously there was a time when you sort of got the impression that probably anybody who was writing seemed to be connected with the Golden Dawn. Do you know what I mean? That sort of influence across it. You've got the charismatic, or I don't know if it's charismatic or non-charismatic, people like Aleister Crowley and that, who are very good at the PR sort of stuff. But I suppose it's this idea that there is something hidden. What is it? You know, the used to be, what was it, the Renaissance art of memory, where if you wanted to memorise something, they used to recommend that you actually thought of a building and you then put your memories on it. And it's almost like the cities become a real art of memory, do you know what I mean? As you wander around the city, it's triggering off certain things. And I mean, I think the occult period of London, because it covers quite a lot of area, there's the classic Golden Dawn, then you've got the more sensational stuff like the vampires in Highgate Cemetery and all that sort of stuff, which become more passed into popular folklore, don't they, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the late 19th century
is
probably the most evocative period. The idea of Whitechapel, Jack the Ripper, Robert Louis Stevenson, that still counts quite strongly today. But there was an upsurge in this view of London as a cult city, I think, from the 80s and 90s onwards. I think it's got tied in also with this political attitude, this idea that London, or hidden London's being erased, this idea that public space is being destroyed by this new sort of faceless corporate identity. And so I think there's been a conscious attempt to revive these occult myths, revive this sense of London as this place of occult and hidden histories to counteract this feeling that London's identity is threatened somehow.
John, yeah?
Well, it's interesting you say that, Merlin, as well. It's a good point, and I think part of it is, as well, I went to the Museum of London recently with my young children, and there's a great museum, I like it a lot, but there's no mention at all of the mythology of London. You know, there's no King Lud doesn't get a look in at all anywhere. I mean, you know, not even going as far as E.O.'s Gordon's prehistoric mounds of London, which I know are, you know, sort of archaeologically contestable. But, you know, things like Lud and Gog Magog and all these things which are integral to the mythology of a place, and a part of a place's story, and they're not stories that are told in London. They're not things that school children learn about in London. Whereas if you go to Rome, you know, everybody that visits Rome can't leave Rome without hearing about Romulus and Remus. You know, you hear that mythology all the time. And it's something they have a lot of, say, in Italy, where they have a very strong sense of civic pride. All those cities have great stories and myths about them, and actually come away with as much of the mythology of the place as you do of the actual history. And by the end, you're not even sure which is which. You know, and that's something in London that we've kind of allowed to be taken away from us. So even if it's not used in the sense of the political aspects of challenging space and ownership of space, it's almost like the idea, the identity and the idea of a place. Who owns the idea of what a place is and where is it from? You know, it's almost like, I met a historian recently who was in London who specialises in indigenous cultures in North America. And, you know, he says what he sees in the psychogeographical tradition in London seems to have been borrowed from what indigenous peoples do in North America and stuff, of reclaiming their history of their place.
Which is to do, I suppose, with the kind of, does the spirit continue? I mean, I'm also interested in what happens when a building that was designed for one purpose, for example, a prison, is then turned into luxury flats. I mean, it amazes me that someone would want to live in the Bryant & May factory, given that we know that the women workers there died early, miserable, painful lives through poisoning, phosphorus poisoning. I mean, if you go to Oxford now, the Malmaison Hotel is the former prison, and you can buy a double, you know, expensive double room, which was probably where someone might have been immiserated, you know, and kept there for 20 years, maybe possibly waiting to be hanged or something like that. Which then raises a question, which I can't answer because I'm a rationalist, but nevertheless, do we sometimes feel when we go into buildings like old prisons, that there's something inheres there, a spirit, or a mean. I mean, Laura, are there places where you feel that, well, something is bizarre or not quite right?
I take issue with the sort of Aykroyd theory of the sort of genius loci idea, you know, because that sort of takes away the notion of human agency, and it's that creates the cities that we live in. You know, that it's not like the stones are imbued with any sort of spirituality. For me. Although, that said, obviously, walking around the city, you do encounter, you know, different, I don't know how you describe it, maybe different ambiences or different experiences or a certain feeling in a certain place that, you know, it's sort of something that's palpable, but you couldn't really articulate it in a very clear kind of way. But I still think that's about the presence of people or the history of people as opposed to something ancient or something spiritual being imbued in the architecture. It's the way that it's been engaged with, I think, for me.
What about your walk along the Fleet, though? Why did you do that, and how does that link into this idea?
Well, the Fleet is a brilliant metaphor, I think, for this idea of the repressed narratives, not just of the city, but in the writing as well. So I kind of talk about the Fleet as this sort of it's a hidden current that's running throughout the city, but it's buried. But there's certain points where it erupts. It's like an uncanny rupturing, you know. And I suppose the attempt I was making was in the writing was to kick open these apertures where these repressed desires of the city or repressed histories could, you know, burst out like the Fleet sometimes bursts because it's all encased now in Victorian brickwork and pipes, so sometimes it bursts out. And yeah, I mean, that's why I chose to do that. I mean, when I select areas to write about in London, it's always places that I've got memories of or some sort of very subjective or poetic engagement with, so I can then fuse that with a more sort of radical critique of what's going on there. You know, it would be very difficult for me to approach the political aspects or issues in an area without having that more emotional engagement with it.
Was there much that comes up with occult London, Merlin, with the Fleet? Because I know I used to walk through there to and from work every day, and I used to walk through an area I now know is called, what's called Black Mary's Hole, which is just off the junction with Rosebery Avenue in Gray's Inn Road. and there's a dip there behind the News Corp. Is it News Corp and Channel 4, Channel 4 News, ITN? That area is, and that, you know, one of the myths of that is that it was a place of sacrifice, or it could have been Black Madonna worship. We don't know. Is that something you've come across, man?
I haven't come across that particular example, though. Although, having researched the book, I did find that virtually every part of London has its own set of occult myths, which are quite sort of jealously guarded. But there do appear to be certain places where occult history seem to stick in London in particular. I mean, going back to Ackroyd again, I mean, his he's written extensively about Clerkenwell as this site of occult significance. Obviously, the whole of the East End appears to be now sort of caught up in this occult conspiracy, but particularly areas like Whitechapel. But speaking personally from where I come in Bayswater, and that seems to have strangely gone off the map when it comes to occult or psychogeographical significance, and seems to have none whatsoever. So when I go on my walks, I have to give myself quite a lengthy head start before I can get anywhere that seems to have any real literary or psychogeographical significance.
I mean, one of the things, I mean, to go back to what Laura was saying about how, you know, some people feel that places have ambience or whatever you want to describe it. There's, I mean, I'm sure we're familiar with the Booth maps, you know, the Blacker Street and all this sort of stuff, you know, where London was mapped looking at its socioeconomic conditions. I mean, one of the things that's quite interesting is this fascination that André Breton first had, that he felt you could actually map the ambience of a city. And, you know, he would be done in a similar format with colour coding and that sort of thing. You know, Breton felt this, I feel attracted towards this place. This place repels me. I have an indifference there. And as with lots of projects, it never got done. But the idea was to actually, for the Surrealist group, to produce a map of Paris that would have been how they felt, which is... It's not exactly the same. Obviously, it's very different to the Booth maps, but it'd been interesting to sort of see. Because one of the things I find quite interesting when I look at the Booth maps is how much has changed and how much hasn't changed in London in terms of its relative poverty and all this sort of stuff. And it's it's quite an interesting way of looking at the city as well. I mean, I think sometimes cartography is not quite as well looked at as various other traditions. And I always found, I mean, one of the things I want to encourage people to do at... in our months and housemans is to draw what I encourage people to produce, what I call the Surrealist map of London. And the Surrealist map of London, when Surrealists did a map of the world, and the map of the world consisted of all the countries that they thought were important to them. And a bit like when a child draws a map, it can be very evocative because it tells you a tremendous amount about their life. It's not particularly representational. I want to encourage people to draw a Surrealist map of London so we can see if it just consists of their local street or whatever. It tells you a lot about the whole way we perceive. And if we got all these people together, it'd be quite interesting to see, well, Merlin's picture of it, my picture of it, Laura's. It'd be quite interesting to see how all the maps fitted together and that sort of thing. And these are the sort of some of the investigations we'd be encouraging people to take part in. And I think, as I said, I think the Booth maps are really interesting because you can actually look at a city in quite a visual way. And I always find it quite interesting to see what's changed, what hasn't changed and that sort of thing. And I'm sure, you know, the same with the occult London. You know, you can draw up maps. I mean, we could use maps to create a multi-dimensional picture of London. People can map their walks. And the other thing quite often is how limited people's lives are. That if you drew a map of where you walked in a week, quite often it would be where you live, it's your place at work, where you live, it's your place at work, and that. And just see how much of the city... You know, you actually expand in that time. Because that was one of the things the Situationists did, was they traced people's journeys. And actually, they realised that people inhabited a very small part of Paris in their daily lives. And obviously, what we do is we, you know, you can either explore these things in great detail. I mean, one of the things that, yeah, I mean, to go back to IKEA and places like that, there's no reason why you shouldn't spend a whole day just exploring a railway station. Although I'm sure nowadays you get stopped and harassed quite a lot.
Well, this brings us back to what Ken was saying as well about walking as a subversive practice. I mean, I feel that especially given that I'm a woman as well, you know. So this idea of sort of being nomadic and free and walking around the city is, you know, still something worth mentioning, I think. But, you know, we were talking earlier about the fact that the entire Liverpool city centre has now become a private gated community. And that the only thing you're allowed to do there is consume, and everything else is classed as criminal activity. So walking around, just drifting, thinking about things, chatting, loitering, smoking, taking photographs, it's all become criminal behaviour. I get the sense that Malcolm's trying to wrap things up a bit. So.
Now, what I want to do is, before we finish, I want to give a plug to the people here for helping us out. And Ken will be giving a talk at Houseman's on Saturday, the 18th of July, from 5 to 6.30. PM, where we'll be talking in more depth about the issues raised here and dockers and detectives. John's kindly allowing us to screen his film on Saturday the 25th of July from 5 PM to 6:30 PM.
Nick will be talking as well with that.
Nick hopefully will be
he'll be doing
talking. Merlin's going to be giving a talk on the 26th of August, which is a Wednesday, from 7 PM to 8:30 PM. And Laura led a walk on Saturday prior to this broadcast being made, so regretfully we can't really plug her in live time. But I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you all both at Houseman's, and we'll all meet up again and do various other projects and take it from there.
Thanks, Malcolm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good.
Okay. Okay, if you'd like to come along to any of the events, Houseman's Bookshop is 5 Caledonian Road, King's Cross, London, N1, 9DX, the proverbial stone throw from King's Cross Station. And all of our events are on our website, which is www.housemans.com.
I've got a website as well, and it's savagemessiahzine.com. And you can get zines from there. But the best place to get my zines is from Houseman's Bookshop. I'm very choosy about the outlets for my zines, so, you know, that's why I've got my work in Houseman's. And you have to go in and ask for Malcolm, and then he'll give you a copy of the zine.
The London Perambulator has a website at HTTP, and all the other gubbins, bits of punctuation, londonperambulator.wordpress.com, and that's where you can hear about future screenings after Houseman screens on the 25th of July, and then there hopefully be more screenings around about. And if you've got somewhere local that you think would be a good place to screen it, pester them and tell them to screen that film. And you can find my blog at islingtongue.blogspot.com. The title of it is Isling Tongue, Leighton's Tongue.
Yeah, I've got a website, www.warpole.net. Particularly if you're interested in Essex, because I spent the last 5 years walking and cycling around the whole of the Essex coastline. I've done one book already, but that is my kind of labour of love, the estuaries and coastline of kind of hidden Essex.
I don't have a website, but once again, if you would like to buy my books, I suggest you head straight to Houseman's and speak to Malcolm.
He doesn't know this, but when his book's published on Utopias, we'll launch it at Houseman's sometime in
I'm
September.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, okay. Thanks very much, everybody, for taking part in this.